From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. When I was a preteen, there was nothing I looked forward to more than watching a double feature at the Alex Theater in Glendale with a tall bucket of popcorn nestled in my lap. Maybe it's because of that movies and food have always been a natural pair in my mind. Last August, we looked at a few movies where food actually plays a starring role on the screen. I wanted to replay it for you. Next week, we'll be back with an all-new episode of Good Food.
The most and the only thing we can expect out of life is to be present with the ones that we love in the moment that we have.
That's Lulu Wong, the director of the feature-length movie The Farewell. The movie's loosely based on her real-life experience of going back to China when she learned her grandmother was diagnosed with lung cancer. Her family decided not to tell her grandmother about her diagnosis. Instead, they planned an impromptu wedding as an excuse to say goodbye. It's a heartbreaking story, full of subtle moments and, of course, food. Last year, Lulu Wong joined us to discuss the family drama at the heart of The Farewell and the power of food to bring us together when words just won't do. Welcome.
Thank you.
When you set out to make the movie, was food at the front of your mind as a storytelling device?
It was, but not in the way that you would necessarily expect. You know, I think that normally when we see a film, a story about an Asian American family, food is always at the forefront of the culture because it's an expression of love. But in my film, because the family is grieving, the one thing that they've lost is their appetite because they're not at a celebration. So they don't really want to eat. But because grandma has gathered the family under the guise of a wedding and a celebration, she continues to feed everybody. And it surprises her when somebody in the family doesn't want to eat or seems to be sort of almost disgusted by the food. And I really wanted to use food in this way to sort of visualize the internal tension that the family is facing, that, you know, the one way they can express love back to Nai Nai, grandma, is by eating her food. But how do you do that when you're grieving and you don't have an appetite?
When you're grieving and you can't show that you're grieving.
Exactly.
Too, because that makes it even harder because the moment doesn't pass.
Exactly.
One of the conflicts in this movie that's so interesting between East and West is the tension between Billy's family, who immigrated to the U.S., and their relatives who stayed in China. How did you experience that conflict in your own life, and how did it inform the story that you wanted to tell?
Well, you know, I think that I've always had to negotiate between my American identity and my Chinese identity. You know, in America, in some ways, I'm never American enough because of the way I look. And in China, I will never really understand or fully be Chinese enough. And yet there's an expectation that I should be, right? Even though I've left, they're like, there's a lot of these reminders, well, you are Chinese and you must respect and honor your roots. And even in making the film, when I told my parents about it, my mother would say, how can you make this film? You don't understand China. And it's almost like, well, then do I not have a story? Am I not allowed my perspective, which is admittedly one that lacks a bit of understanding? And is that my fault, you know? But I wasn't raised there. I came to this country when I was six, and my parents raised me in a way to be very assimilated so that I would feel at home in America with American culture.
And like Billy's uncle says to her at one point in the movie, pulls her aside and says, look, the fact that we've decided to keep the truth from your grandmother has to do with our culture, which is different than the culture you grew up in, which is individual.
Mm-hmm.
Ours is more about society, history, family.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I found so interesting was in the first scene that we see the family all together in Nai Nai's apartment in China, everyone's cooking. And even though people don't necessarily want to eat, that act of preparation and engagement is a way for people to be next to each other, allow all the dynamic that happens within families to play out mm-hmm. in the scene without even really eating. And it's where you see Billy for the first time start to have to kind of parse her own feelings about what's going to unfold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it was very much an introductory scene to this family. It's why we shot it the way we did, where, you know, everybody's isolated and framed in the frame, were over the shoulders of the other family members. You don't see who they're sitting next to. Everybody is covered except for the you know, the one person that we're introducing. And you kind of see where Grandma's state of mind is. She's very excited to be preparing this wedding. She's excited for this reunion, and where everybody else's state of mind is. They're, you know, privately, silently grieving.
So who chose the food that would be in some of those scenes? It's interesting because often in movies that dwell with family drama, but also have a lot of food within the scenes, the food is idealized. The food mm-hmm. almost becomes a character.
Exactly.
But in your movie, the food is, it's very realistic.
Yeah. And that was important to me, that I wanted the food and the eating to be part of the texture of the family, of life, and not above it, not romanticized, not idealized, and not made to be food porn, because I think that's a very American thing to suddenly, oh, we've discovered food culture, so now we're all foodies. And in these ancient cultures, nobody is a foodie and nobody's a non-foodie. Everybody just eats food and good food, you know? And it's especially in middle class or lower, even lower income families in the villages, out in the farms, people don't have a lot of access to really high quality food, and meat is very expensive. So they really just, you know, value every little bit that they can get. And it's the thing that brings the family together. It's the thing that brings joy to the family. Yeah. So I'm glad that you said that. It was important for me to make it realistic and not, you know, do these like solo close-up shots on it as a way to sort of elevate or romanticize it in any way.
And I often think that that also sometimes takes away from the story. It's like, let's have this interlude where it's just about the food. One of the most interesting for me moments in the movie to watch was when Billy goes with her family to leave offerings at her grandfather's grave. And the family that has remained and is still very tied to tradition is yelling out instructions to the family that is more removed from traditions about what to do.
Yeah.
Like, you put the oranges down. No, you're supposed to peel the oranges. And at the beginning, it seems so chaotic mm-hmm. and disparate. But as you pan back from them and you see them as a group going through this, it's clear how unified they are.
Yes. You know, what I was trying to say with that scene and with showing these rituals is that in a way, it's more for the living than it is for the dead. These rituals are a way that brings the family together, that unites them. And no one really has the answers as to what is the right way, because, you know, China's a very, very large country, first and foremost. So even while we were shooting that scene, I was talking to the art department and the crew about, okay, how we were going to approach the scene and what we should actually put down first. And the crew started arguing. The crew started going, well, in my family, you know, you got to put the pears first, because pears have this specific meaning. And if you put that later, then it's a curse. And then other people said, no, but you have to put the napkin, and we always put the fruit later, and we burn the incense first. And so everyone started arguing. I said, guys, that's the point of the scene, is that there is no one way. We don't have to figure this out, you know, and you're actually proving the point of the scene. And they kind of all looked at me and they were like, yeah, okay, but I still think that you should, you know. I just went back into it and I was like, all right, whatever, you guys can figure it out. I don't care how it's done.
Very, very powerful and funny at mm-hmm. the same time. And also it helped chart Billy's sort of journey between being so resistant to the lie and then coming to some kind of peace.
Yeah.
Did that happen with you?
Yeah, I think so. I think that I came to peace, not necessarily with the lie itself, but just more with, you know, the fact that there are multiple truths, that there are lots of different ways of doing things, and we can all coexist, you know, and ultimately it's not about right or wrong. It's about the time that we can spend together, and hopefully in as truthful, as honest a way as possible without talking about the one elephant in the room, can we still have a really joyful and honest moment as a family? And in some ways, like that experience, that wedding, that goodbye was more meaningful than any other we've ever had, you know, any other reunion, because everyone saw how ephemeral it is and that it could be the last time. And so I think that everyone was really present in that moment.
Okay, so this is kind of a silly question, but I'm curious. During a group photo, everyone is instructed to say eggplant.
Mm-hmm.
What's the Mandarin word for eggplant, and is it a common photo op directive?
It is. It's the cheese of China.
So say it. I want to see your mouth smile.
Okay, it's 茄子. So I love that they say eggplant, because I think both that the eggplant is in the shape of a smile, but also when you say it, 茄子, it makes your mouth smile.
Where are your recommendations to get some of the dishes here in LA that are featured in the film?
Okay, I just have to tell you, this was a huge drama.
Why?
When I was told that I had to find restaurants, because honestly, I don't know, right? And so, you know, I'll go out to San Gabriel Valley when my family's in town and my parents take me, but I just follow them. I go where they take me. I never know what the name of the restaurant is. And I don't take that many trips out there on my own because I'm busy. And my brother and I, once in a while, will go, but a lot of the restaurants we've been to have closed. So I called my mother before getting here and we got in a fight. I said, Mom, can you please, like, help me? Because if I look in English, I'm not going to find the good ones. Can you Google it in Chinese? And she says, well, I don't live in LA. Let me call, you know, my friend who lives in LA. And she goes, you call my friend who lives in LA. I said, I don't want to call your friend. You call your friend. I got to get to the station in like 10 minutes. Also, she's going to tell me the Chinese name, but I don't know Chinese, so I don't know how to say that on the radio. So you need to tell her, get the Chinese name, plug it into the Chinese internet, and then find me the English name. And we fought about this for a good 10
hashtag
minutes.
Hashtag parents.
Hashtag parents, hashtag, like, you know, I think that any, you know, second generation or very, like, young age coming over first generation immigrant like myself will understand this, is that, you know, I'm as clueless as any other American.
So while you're looking this up, I love that you have your phone out.
She sent me a few.
Okay.
Yeah.
We should explain that there's this one great moment where Nai Nai uses her strength to go out to the banquet hall where the wedding is going to be held. And it's a way of exercising her control and her vigor still. And she gets in a fight with the hotel management and the chef, saying that she was promised lobster. And they're like, no, it was crab. It was always crab.
Yes. And that's, you know, when we were shooting that scene, a lot of the Chinese crew were like, ugh, this is such a typical thing to happen, you know, where in order to bait you into making the reservation, they'll tell you one thing, but then you show up and it's this other thing, and you have nowhere to go to complain, and it's too late. And so everyone expressed their frustration, because I guess things like that have happened to them before.
So during the wedding banquet scene, we see platter after platter after platter of whole crabs coming to the table.
Yes. Okay, so you want the restaurants? Okay.
Sure.
So we looked up specifically, I asked her to ask her friend to look up specifically Northern Chinese cuisine to suggest some Northern restaurants that she goes to.
And is this a reference to the meat pies that we see at the beginning of the movie?
You know, I'm not sure. They may serve them, they may not, but like dough products, dumplings, meat pies tend to be their own restaurants, like, because they're so hard to make that a lot of restaurants specialize just in that. I'll just sort of prerequisite and say that I haven't been to these restaurants.
We understand.
Recommendation from my mother's friend who lives in San Gabriel Valley. There's one called Xin Yang Restaurant, Shenyang. It is on San Gabriel Boulevard.
And what are we eating there?
It's a specialized in northern Chinese cuisine in the Dongbei, which means northeast region. And so you're going to get a lot of the foods that was in the movie. And another one, also northern Chinese, is simply called Northern Chinese. And it is 8450 East Valley Boulevard in Rosemead.
I love this so much. You have no idea how perfect this is for our audience.
I hope that like lots of white people just show up and be like, I heard this on the radio. Lulu's mother's friend lives around here and said I should come. It'll be an adventure. Please find me on Twitter and tell me how it goes. That would be very exciting for me.
So funny. So what's next for you? Are you going to continue to mine your life for story ideas?
Yeah, always. I mean, I think that everything I make is an exploration of a personal question that I have about humanity, about relationships, about family. And they tend to be questions that I don't have an answer to and probably will never find an answer to. But, you know, my films are a way for me to at least explore those questions. So I am, you know, you'll be interested in this. I am working on a TV series about my brother's life, and he is a chef. And he works in Los Angeles, and he dropped out of school when he was 19, to my parents' dismay, to become a chef. And now he is a very successful sous chef at the age of 25. He's the sous chef of Auburn in Los Angeles on Melrose.
I'm the emoji with the head blowing off.
Yeah, and he's never cooked. He doesn't cook Chinese food.
He cooks,
you know. You know, like it's like a very elevated tasting menu, California French cuisine. But I think eventually he wants to open his own restaurant. So if there's any investors out there, hit us up. His name is Anthony Wong. He's amazing. The show is going to be called Family Meal, which is the meal that the entire restaurant staff comes together to eat before the start of dinner service.
Oh, we can't wait.
You can also visit him at Auburn. He says he's had people come visit him. I wrote him out of the movie, but people, like, we did this New York Times piece and people read it, and so they show up at his restaurant to talk to him about the movie. It's amazing.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Lulu.
Thank you.
That was director Lulu Wong talking with me about her film, The Farewell. To learn more about the restaurant she mentioned, visit kcrw.com/goodfood. In a moment, we turn to a documentary about a couple who left city life behind to try and farm 200 acres of barren land outside of Los Angeles. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman, and we've been looking back at some movies where food plays a starring role.
You're scarred, but you're also deeply rooted into, you know, what nature's language is, which is way different than ours.
That's Emmy Award-winning filmmaker John Chester. Some years back, he and his partner Molly were evicted from their Santa Monica apartment, so they did what we all dream of: pack up their life and set out to become sustainable farmers. They ended up on a defunct avocado ranch in the foothills of Ventura County, 200 acres of land as dead as can be. The first time I stepped foot onto Apricot Lane Farm, it was early on in the project, and yet it felt ripe with possibility. On my second visit, it was as if I had stepped into some kind of agricultural energy field with life pulsing all around me. It was stepping into the pages of E.B. White's Charlotte's Web with frolicking animals and stone fruit orchards. And all of it is just an hour northwest of Los Angeles in Moorpark, which you might think of as SoCal suburbia. The Biggest Little Farm is a documentary about the transformation of Apricot Lane Farm, I'm joined by John and Molly Chester now to talk about their 8-year journey and the making of this film.
And I am so happy to have you both here.
Aw, we're so happy to be here.
Yeah, so glad that we've been on this journey together in a way.
I feel so lucky to have watched the transformation from pretty early on. And I'm so grateful that you made this film because people seem to think that it's like a magic wand. Let's talk about Molly's insane enthusiasm and how that pushed you to begin the project.
Yeah. So my journey came from in my 20s, my health declined a bit. I was a vegetarian. I like to say I was kind of an unhealthy vegetarian. I didn't know how to do it properly. It was lots of soy dogs and soy crumbles and things like that. And I landed myself really behind the eight ball. And to correct that, I started really connecting how what I ate changed how I felt. And from there, it became a passion that became culinary school. And as I went deeper into what is nutrition and how really to get the body to absorb that nutrition, it became first about the health of your own gut and understanding diversity within that. But then it became about the choices a farmer makes, because you can do all sorts of things in the kitchen to maximize nutrient density with soaking and sprouting and fermenting. But then it really is that you have to start with something nutritious. So as I started sourcing food for our clients and going to see farmers and meat farmers, we couldn't find the type of eggs that we wanted, and our dog would not stop barking. So the combo of those two things led us to pursue trying to find a farm, and here we are.
So this farm, from the very beginning, was very ambitious. It's a lot of acreage. It required a huge investment. And for that, you turned to investors.
Mm-hmm. And we had to really align with someone that already saw the future in food as not just going back to food that had great depth of flavor, but food that was nutrient dense and that flavor was informed by the health of the soil. And the bonus was doing it in an ecologically enhancing way where you're regenerating the land versus just the extractive methods that we've become so used to over the last 75 years.
So one of the most fascinating parts of the film is it's almost organized in a call and response fashion where there's like a problem and then panic.
Yeah.
And then calm and then a solution that is still within the context of this very natural system, this eight that you're trying to create, not just in the soil, but throughout the entire ecosystem. So let's talk about some of those really difficult things. I mean, first of all, the soil, the difference in the soil between when you first got it and how many years in?
Eight.
Yeah.
It's insane. I mean, it's a dirt clod versus something that you could just stick your arm into.
Yeah. Right.
How hopeful, right?
Yeah. I mean, it took 45 years of extractive farming to destroy that soil, but it only took 7 to 8 years of conscious farming to rebuild it to better than what it was. And that's a lot. I think that gives a lot of hope.
Your sort of guru on this journey was this extraordinary man, Alan York, who's known for biodynamic farming, which some people kind of poo-poo, but
yeah,
the basic thread of it is this soil building.
Yeah.
Yeah. We look at organic farming, but not many people really understand there's no requirement for organic farming to rebuild and regenerate soil. So whether you call it biodynamic, regenerative, or holistic, even permaculture, all these methods now, the common agreement is if you don't have soil regenerating techniques, then you're not really doing anything new for the land or for the food that you're growing.
What really struck me in the film is how willing the two of you were to go along on Alan's ride.
Willing? We didn't show some of the stuff that was happening at night.
The fights.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it was so, like, yeah, he spoke in very, at the time, I thought flowery terms. But now when I watch it, I'm like, oh my gosh, I understand everything he was saying. And it took 8 years for me to get to the point where I understood it. But yeah, we kind of had to go because he basically was like, you can't have a foot in both sides of the circle. You need to really go deep. And the one thing that we learned is that there's so much humiliation and embarrassment in the failure. But what we learned with Alan and sometimes without is that you had to go deep into that humiliation and embarrassment before you made an attempt at a solution, because you had to understand the problem so deeply But normally because of that humiliation and embarrassment, you want to turn away, turn around and fix the problem, but it's very short-sighted.
Yeah.
Give me an example.
Well, yeah, gophers. I would say,
Morning Glory.
All right, so the first thing we did is we grew cover crop in order to build soil. Well, that created the worst gopher problem in Ventura County. In fact, if we can sell gopher meat, we would be the richest farmers in the world right now. So we had the worst gopher problem started because we tried to help the soil.
Is that because the roots dangling down?
They love clover. They love roots. The tender roots of grass are their favorite. And the second choice is the roots of our orchard trees. So the immediate reaction of most common sense farmer would be get rid of the cover crop. It's doing nothing but causing problems. But we stayed with it. And we learned two things. One, gophers don't attack roots that are older of older orchard trees. So as the trees got older, they were less susceptible to the gopher damage. But the other thing was, we started realizing there are all these things within our farm that were going to start to come and solve that problem. Barn owls, they eat, you know, anywhere from 20 to 40,000 gophers off our farm a year. Badgers, weasels, gopher snakes, all these things started showing up. But it wasn't like in a year they showed up. It was over the period of 5 years. So we had to go and stick with it long enough to allow the ecosystem to respond. And it just doesn't do it on the timeline that our human capacity for patience really understands.
Let's talk about the chickens, because your first huge success from a commercial and consumer standpoint are the eggs. I mean, here in Southern California, Apricot Lane eggs are famous. Wherever they go, they sell out in minutes. And those eggs happened because?
We did a 5-year study on the nutrient quality of the eggs. And over the 5 years, you know, vitamin A levels went up, lutein went up, omega-3 to omega-6 ratio went up. We were feeding them the same supplemental feed. The only thing that changed over that 5-year period was what? The health of the soil.
Bugs.
Right. The health of the bugs living in that soil and the grass growing from that soil. So once we figured out that and we were able to, you know, collect that data, of course that's going to translate to most anything else on the farm.
So the sort of showpiece of the farm are the orchards. How many different varieties did Alan make you plant?
We have 75 different varieties of fruit trees in that block. And now the purpose of it is to put them in, figure out what works and doesn't. We wanted to maximize flavor, so we knew that we would be heading towards product lines because you don't have a lot of shelf life for that. And then from there, we would graft over things that weren't working to things that were. And so we've started that process, but you have to be very patient to figure out what works because it takes many years.
Predators are another factor of farm life. And you say in some cases, observation followed by creativity became your greatest ally. In other circumstances, you had to question your approach, like the coyotes. That was brutal. I mean, you had these beautiful animals.
Yeah, that's a really big turning point in the story because we had coyotes that killed 350 chickens in this ideology that we were going to live in harmony with nature. I mean, we looked ridiculous and we're not very popular among our team because they were like, how could you let one coyote live and 350 chickens die? But there's this amazing moment that happens in the film where we sort of draw this conclusion and we do end up solving the coyote problem, but sort of not in the way you might think. And there is a purpose to the coyote. The coyote is also eating gophers and rabbits. And we literally can watch our rabbit population go up. And then 6 weeks later, the population goes down and you hear the coyotes running through the farm at night. And coyotes are also pollinators of, you know, any animal that moves across the landscape is a native pollinator. So you start to begin to develop this awareness for these things, but it creates this, it's not about right and wrong in farming. It all becomes this sort of experience of consequences and how long you can last in the game, because consequences will tell you the truth, but sometimes it takes longer, and that's your right and wrong. And so that story is very important in the film.
And then we should just say, as a place to go visit, it's this lovely bucolic sort of moment in Southern California landscape, animal husbandry, botany, agriculture, climate, bird migration, the eggs. And I was so happy to see when you walked in, you handed me a bag and there's a product from the fruit.
Yeah, I know. It only took us 8 years to get there. But we do. We have a bourbon lemon marmalade. It's our very first. It uses whole cane sugar, so sucanat, and then a biodynamic evaporated cane sugar. and our lemons and some Journeyman bourbon, and it's really delicious. And avocado oil. So we press with our Hass avocados, and that is a wonderful oil because it has a super high cooking temperature. So you can grill. It's a stable at room temperature with a liquid oil that you can also go super high with, and it's kind of uncommon and buttery and good.
So how can people visit the farm?
Well, we do tours. So right now we're doing about once a month, and you want to log on to Apricot Lane Farms and sign up to receive the notifications, because that's how you get the first word that there is a tour, because right now they are selling out pretty quickly.
We announced the first tour recently. The website got hit by 36,000 people at the same time, and it crashed the site. And then when its site came back up, we sold 400 tickets in 10 minutes. So we are trying to catch up, so be patient. It's so crazy, the enthusiasm.
So let's talk about the film. Where can people watch it?
Well, I know it's still playing in some theaters here. It's been out for almost 10 weeks now, but I know in Southern California it's still playing in a few theaters. And then it'll be available for streaming and DVD here towards the end of August.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan.
Thanks so much.
That's John and Molly Chester of Apricot Lane Farm. We've been talking about The Biggest Little Farm, the film that John directed about their journey. After the break, we turn to a documentary that was the most awarded film at Sundance last year, my interview with the filmmakers behind Honeyland, when we return. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman, and we've been revisiting last year's show about movies and food. Picture a woman living in a remote settlement at the edge of the world. She makes her home among ancient ruins, soaring rock faces, and arid valleys. In her world, there are no cell phones, no internet. Her elderly mother is failing and half blind. To help them survive, she cultivates honey from wild bees, using methods as old as humans. If any of this sounds like a fiction, it's not. It's real, and it was documented in stunning detail in Honeyland, the most awarded film at last year's Sundance Festival. I was joined by the pair behind Honeyland, Tamara Kotevska and Lyubomir Stefanov.
Hi, how are the two of you?
Hi, good, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for inviting us.
And congratulations. You know, when it first starts to spool out in front of you, you're thinking that you're watching one of the most incredible National Geographic-style documentaries ever. But then it starts to morph. It takes place in the mountains of Macedonia. What can you tell us about the people who live in that region and about that region?
Well, this is a very interesting region, like on the sides of the river Bregalnica, because this river changes its natural flow every more than 10 years, let's say. And with this, the complete civilizations and cultures around this river and in this area change also. And it's interesting that you can find on the same place artifacts and evidence from the Romans to the Second World War to Turks to many, many different civilizations. Atice is one of the last remaining inhabitants from the tribe Kazalbashi, which is an old Turkish tribe. And they're not much different from the culture or the religion. But what makes her specifically different and how she lives her life is specifically the wild bee hunting and in the rule that never gets broken, which is different from all the other people in the area and how they keep their bees. And this rule is the most important rule that we apply to in the film, which is take half, but leave half to the bees. And this refers to all nature. Everything that nature gives us as a resource, we must be aware to take half, but leave the other half to the nature so it can revive itself.
Could you describe the kind of beekeeping that she practices? I mean, some of the most incredible parts of the movie are all the shots where she's really close, she's unprotected, and it's very intimate. She sings to them, she talks to them. It's like they're her children.
I don't know how many. It's not a big number of people who are hunting wild bees, but there are also other people. And first, actually, we found her brothers. They moved from the village a long time ago, and they have families, they have children, grandchildren. And they're also hunting wild bees and taking wild honey, but in a very different way. What we saw when we find her, it was that exotic relationships between her and the bees, and that singing, that communications with the bees.
It's
unique. We can't explain that.
It's like the ancient world lives in the now.
Probably something like that.
I understand that you ended up following her for a long time, 3 years?
Yeah.
What were some of the challenges in doing that? Did you go back like every month, every 4 times a year? What was your rhythm with her?
Well, we tried to go, we usually went every weekend. I mean, this was later when we met the other family, because the children were coming to Bekirlia when they didn't have school. So it's for the weekends and all the summer, let's say. And before that, with Atija, we went maybe 3 days a week.
Before we meet the other family, which is a whole other part of the film, whole other part of the story. I mean, she's just, as a person, as a character, she's incredible. You have this woman who dresses in traditional dress. And when she goes to Skopje, the capital city, to sell her honey, you would think that she would navigate like a country, what we would call a country bumpkin, somebody who was very naive. But in fact, she completely holds her own. She's very smart.
She's very sharp.
Very funny.
And although she don't have even primary education, she's speaking 4 languages fluently. 4 different groups of languages. She speaks Turkish, Macedonian, she speaks, which is Slavic language. She speaks Albanian, which is isolate, and she speaks Roman fluently.
I mean, you managed to find a singular person. It's very rare in this world.
We are aware of that.
Very rare.
Maybe it's not that rare, but you need to look more carefully, and people are very ignorant these days. So
it's true. One of the things that makes this movie so fascinating is how it turns when the family comes next door. You think you're watching one story, and then all of a sudden, all of these themes erupt out of the conflict between her and this family, and it almost seems like it's scripted. There's some times where you're watching this, and you're like, this cannot be a documentary.
But when you see the scenes, when they're so
real. This is a compliment, actually. Thank you.
I mean, because you had no idea that these people are going to show up. And so right there in this tiny space, there's going to be a conflict between modernity and the ancient world.
These people, when they showed up, we ignored them for a while because we didn't find them necessary, let's say, in the story. We were focused on Atija. And as she started opening more to us, she told us about all the conflicts that they have. It's not only with the bees, they have other conflicts. And that's the moment when we decided we must find a way to approach these people because they're a crucial part of her life. And we decided to stick just with this conflict, just with the bees, because this was what we needed for the story.
She must have seen the film. She saw the film.
Yes,
she did.
And what did she think?
She liked it.
She loves seeing herself telling the story. The first time when we came there, she said, "It was my dream that one day some journalist came and shoot me while I was walking on the hills." So she doesn't make a difference between journalists and TV crew and film crew. But she thinks that she is the one who found us, not vice versa. So she was a part of this very strongly, and she loved being out there with people, out with her story. And when the premiere happened in Macedonia, after the premiere, there was a party. She came and she grabbed the microphone from the band and started singing. And that was one of the best parties that happened in Skopje.
Incredible.
So she enjoys it very much.
I don't want to give away the ending and what happens, because it's just, the way it unfolds is just extraordinary. Is she still living in the same space on her own?
No. After we went to Sarajevo Film Festival, that was the first festival we attended, with work in progress, with the assembly of materials. It wasn't even first cut. We won the award from Turkish National Television, and it was like 30,000 euros. And with this award, we made sure to buy a house for her in the next village that has basic living conditions, because this is what she wanted after the death of her mother. And now she's moving back and forth between the new house, where she's close to her relatives, and the old one.
You know, she has a choice now.
I'm so happy. Is she still cultivating bees?
Yes.
She is. Okay, that makes me feel good. And in fact, I have a tiny little jar of honey here. Okay, I'm going to taste this honey.
Sure.
Oh, it's delicious. What are the flowers?
I can't
mountain,
say.
Mountain
this
flowers.
This is a food mountain, show, you know. We're supposed to have... I'm just kidding.
It's very interesting with this honey that every time it tastes completely different.
Depending on the vegetation.
The season and the flowers around.
Wow. This is something very precious. Thank you.
You're welcome.
As is this film you made. Really something very, very special. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last year, I had a conversation with filmmakers Tamara Kotevska and Lyubomir Stefanov. Their film is Honeyland. It's the new year, and hopefully you aren't still nursing a wicked headache from all the festivities. Last year, I spoke with someone who canvassed the globe looking for a hangover cure.
Cabbage has been a staple as far as hangover remedies going back not hundreds, but thousands of years. And it turns out cabbage has what we would call a chelating effect, which means that it goes into the body and hooks onto certain toxins and pulls it out with them when it leaves your body.
That's Shaughnessy Bishop Stahl. He's a Canadian journalist who spent a decade trying every cure he could find for an ailment that's long plagued humanity. You know, the common hangover. His riveting and often side-splitting book is titled Hungover: The Morning After and One Man's Quest for a Cure.
So this book that you've written called Hungover is one of the funniest things I've ever read.
Really? That is so nice to hear.
Well, there's just so much weirdness in it. So could you give me a scientific explanation of why we get hangovers?
I will try. There's been very little research into this over millennia, and the scientists out there all sort of disagree, and I'm not a scientist, so those are all my caveats. But the best I can do is to suggest that it is, in fact, an immune system response to the idea of toxic invaders in our body, so that when we start breaking down alcohol, there are a certain amount of byproducts that start being released into our system. But essentially, our body goes into a sort of emergency mode. One of the things that happens is that all the cells in our body become inflamed. This makes our organs go rigid, which disallows them to absorb water, basically. That's when the dehydration kicks in. The cells in your organs are too rigid to allow water in. And then we also start sending out these kamikaze troops called free radicals to go and try to mop up some of these toxins that are being produced throughout our body. And even after they've done their job, they don't know when to stop. So they keep roaming around our body looking for fights wherever they can. It's really a horrible domino effect that is extremely complicated. And people are still trying to figure out how it starts, how it works, and if we should even stop it.
When did the actual term hangover start being used in the common vernacular?
It's an extremely recent word for a malady that goes back before language. You know, it's really within the past century. And even then, it didn't come into common parlance until, I'd say, between the two world wars. So that's how recent it is. And yet it's been embraced, not just in the English language, but all over the world to describe this particular affliction.
So how was it referred to before?
Crapulence, or the Jim Jams, or just feeling really crummy. There's also a certain amount of confusion, it seems, through much of history between drunkenness and hangover, and not really always seeing that line, it just being spoken about as the extension of drunkenness.
Wow, that's an interesting person who would not find that line. How did the Industrial Revolution change what it is that we drink?
It changed it hugely, but I'd say that more so it changed how we drink, because it would have been distillation that would have changed what we drink. The Industrial Revolution put our drinking time into small compartments, at least those in the lower and middle classes throughout the Western world and other parts of the world. Because whereas we would have drunk slowly throughout the days, you know, sweating out the alcohol, maybe drink an hour in the fields, and that's about at the rate our body wants to process alcohol, suddenly you'd be staying as part of the sober workforce throughout the entire day, and then everybody would meet in the pub at the end of the day and drink as much as they could for a couple of hours, and then go back into one long sleep, wake up into a hangover, and start it all over again. It was also when we started sleeping in one long sleep instead of two sleeps like we had for most of human history. And I think those two sleeps really helped our bodies avoid the horrors and the mechanism of hangover as well.
So I understand that the practice of taking a shot of olive oil before one begins to drink is a pretty common practice.
At least through the Mediterranean world. And I made a really big mistake when I tested it out. I mixed it with another sort of ancient folkloric remedy, and it went very badly. I could tell you about that if you like.
Yeah, sure.
Sure. Okay. It was a few Christmases ago I decided to test out the old Victorian chimney sweep method. Basically, chimney sweeps would try to make a few extra bucks around Christmas time by selling these little, what they called hangover cures, that were just little bags of soot that they'd pulled out of the fireplaces. And you were to mix it in eggnog or milk and drink it down before imbibing. And there is some reasoning to that. We know what charcoal can do as far as filtering out toxins. But I did that. It didn't taste that bad. It turned my teeth purple. I made the mistake of mixing it with that other remedy, belting down some olive oil. And I think that the two remedies together was a really bad idea. I had possibly the worst Boxing Day in history.
Let's turn our attention to cures. I think one of the weirdest ones that I just don't really understand, maybe you can explain it to me, is squeezing a lime in your armpit.
Yeah, that's a Puerto Rican tradition as far as I know. I've tried it. I can't say that it did much for me. It might work as a distraction. There is a school of remedy where basically the more complicated you can make the remedy, the more distracted you'll be from your own pain. So it might fall into that category.
And then what about an IV drip? Most of us think, well, it's an IV drip, you know, the banana bag. That has to really work, right?
Let's cut to the chase here, which is that I think once you've got a hangover, once it's started, you're really into the realm of treating it rather than curing it. And by treating it, I mean trying to shorten the duration and lessen the degree. And the IV drip, as long as you've got the right stuff in there, which would be essentially a rendition of what's known as the Myers cocktail because of the person who invented it, which has all sorts of magnesiums and electrolytes and vitamins and amino acid supplements, etc. in it. It can help you finally hydrate by lessening the inflammation in your body, letting your body absorb a bit of that water, etc. That, along with some much more adrenaline-filled remedies that I came up with, are perhaps the most effective things for the morning after once you have a hangover. But if you really want to cure a hangover, it has to be done before the mechanism starts. It has to be done between drinking and before sleeping.
Okay. So usually what most people I know do in that period is consume great amounts of very greasy food.
That's not going to help, to tell you the truth. I mean, having done that at the beginning of the night would have been more helpful. You definitely want some food for your stomach to be focused on before it starts focusing on the alcohol.
Okay. What is your secret way?
This is something that works for me. I am not prescribing this to anybody else, and I'm not suggesting it will work for other people or that they should do this. But now I go into great detail in how this works in the book. But to give you a general idea, what we're talking about are a mix of some very specific vitamin Bs, then a specific sorts of magnesium, an amino acid supplement called N-acetyl-L-cysteine. That's probably the most important ingredient. A natural anti-inflammatory that's not going to tax your liver. What I use is actually frankincense. It can be found in health food stores under the Latin name Boswellia.
So you ingest frankincense or you inhale it?
I take all of these in pill form. The frankincense is an oil in a capsule. I take them all at the same time, and timing is everything. I take them before I fall asleep and at the end of drinking.
Wow, that's like a serious amount of homework and commitment to do that. So let's go back to some of the more outlandish remedies that you've come across. Since we've had so many centuries of being human and ingesting too much and trying to figure out a way.
Mm-hmm. One scientist, actually a very well-respected scientist of the age, insisted that all you have to do is put leaves of hemlock between your foot and the sole of your shoe and walk around for a few hours. You know, almost every culture has suggested eggs of some bird prepared in some certain way. All the way up to now, I mean, if you look at our, you know, like you said, the greasy breakfast, whether it's the American bacon and eggs or the proper British fry-up, or just putting an egg in a beer and calling it a red eye, eggs seem to be the most constant in breakfast concoctions. And it turns out that they actually have in them N-acetyl-L-cysteine, which is the main ingredient in my modern-day concoction, can be found in eggs.
Wow. Well, the book is immensely entertaining, so thank you so much for that.
Thank you for saying such nice things about the book. I really appreciate it. I'm glad you enjoyed it, and I hope everybody out there will too.
Last year, I spoke with Shaughnessy Bishop Stahl about his book, Hungover, The Morning After and One Man's Quest for the Cure. Let us know if you think he's found it. After the break, we close out with a new restaurant review from LA Times restaurant critic Patricia Escarcega. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Up next, we take a look at somewhere in LA to expand our palates. Taking us is Patricia Escarcega, restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, Evan. Thank you for having me.
I'm thrilled. Where are we going?
Today, we're headed to Silver Lake, Sunset Boulevard. We're going to Spoon and Pork.
So I have to tell you that when I read this review, that pork was like just burned into some lobe of my brain. So talk to me about this menu and in particular, the patita.
Yes. Spoon and Pork, they describe the restaurant as modern Filipino comfort food. And if you grew up eating Filipino comfort food, then you are well versed in crispy pata. And the guys at Spoon and Pork are doing a really singular take on that classic dish. It's a massive deep-fried pig's trotter, and it comes out covered in like a sweet chili sauce. They don't serve it with a fork. The restaurant started its life as a food truck, and when it was a food truck, they would serve it simply with a popsicle stick, and that tells you a lot about the texture of the pig's trotter. The meat simply just flakes off the bone, and the flavor is so rich and so memorable. I think in the review I say, you know, when you eat out as much as I do, you eat a lot of pork, you eat a lot of beef, you eat a lot of animal protein, but this dish really stuck out for me this year. It's such a remarkable, well-executed version of crispy pata.
So it started out its life as a food truck and also, I think, found a lot of customers and acclaim at Smorgasburg.
That's right. I believe I've heard reports of people wandering around there with a giant crispy pata, which I never got to see it myself, but it sounds, formidable. I completely agree with that kind of lunch choice.
So introduce us to the chefs. Who are they?
Yeah, they're two young guys. They call themselves Manila Boys, the Manila Boys. And I'm sorry, guys, if I mispronounce your name, Ray Yaptinchai and Jay Tugas. They're two really amiable, friendly guys. They've been friends since high school. Both their parents, both their mothers, I should say, were flight attendants with the Filipino Airlines. So they grew up together really close, flying to Los Angeles. And they're home cooks, which is kind of remarkable when you taste their food. That's, they learned a lot from watching YouTube videos, Food Network. I believe Jay took some classes, some culinary, he has some culinary training, but a lot of what they've learned was just experimenting in the home kitchen and playing with their favorite vehicle, which is pork.
I have to say that other dishes that you describe in the review sound, if not equally monumental, equally tasty. So let's veer into vegetables just for a minute and describe the eggplant dish.
Oh, the eggplant dish is really lovely. I'm pulling up a picture of it right now on my computer. So you get this Chinese eggplant, which is it's not sliced as you might imagine. It's cooked all in one piece. It's roasted. It's served with a delicious sauce. It's really a meaty dish, even though there's no pork belly in sight. I also want to call out their Calderata Bravas, which is an homage to Tugas's. His father is from Spain, so they wanted to do a little nod towards that heritage. So very crispy potatoes. Again, you get the sense of people who are chefs who have really mastered the menu because they've cooked it for so long in such a tiny kitchen in a truck that everything that comes out of the kitchen is just really, really spot on, first rate, kind of practiced, hours and hours. You have the 10,000 hours have been put in. You could taste it on the plate.
Well, thank you so much, Patricia.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
That was Patricia Escarcega, restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times. That is it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, listen on our website or in KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. And please, leave us a review if you like the show. My thanks go to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Jacqueline Kim. I'm Evan Kleinman, and I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.